Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Denver, Colorado for a State of the Science Summit on gastrointestinal malignancies, which featured insights from University of Colorado and Rocky Mountain Cancer Center's faculty. Meeting topics span the importance of molecular testing in the management of newly diagnosed metastatic colorectal cancer, advances with biomarker-directed therapies and immunotherapies in the relapsed refractory setting, and the role of tumor-sidedness in the treatment of the disease. Experts also highlighted novel approaches being explored in pancreatic cancer, data with immunotherapy in gastric and gastroesophageal junction cancer, and novel investigational agents in hepatocellular carcinoma. To kick off the meeting, we sat down with the evening's chair, Wells A. Messersmith, MD, co-director of the Developmental Therapeutics Program and director of the GI Cancer Program at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. Messersmith explained that although the average survival of patients with metastatic colorectal cancer hovers just around 3 years, gleaning a better understanding of where the tumor originated and knowing more about the increasing array of molecular markers can help to optimize outcomes. In our interview, Messersmith highlighted how treatment has evolved in recent years, some of the key trials that inspired those changes, and the use of molecular testing.
The biggest change, I think, has been the number of options to treat patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. When I started working in this field about 17 years ago or so, there really were a very limited number of agents, sort of hardly any targeted agents and just a couple cytotoxic agents, and now we have this huge sort of armamentarium of different things that we can use, both in the cytotoxic side with both oral and IV medicines, and then a whole bunch of different targeted therapy. So I think one is just the number of options we have, and the second is how much better patients are doing overall, in the sense that for certain subtypes, even in the advanced disease setting, survival is almost in the 40-month range. And obviously we want to cure people, that the goal is to do much better than that. But when you think about where we were, 15, 20 years ago, where most patients were living, 6 to 12 months, it's really come a long way. The key trials that I discussed were the first-line trials with bevacizumab, which is a antibody against VEGF-A. And there's been a number of different trials with various combinations, but overall, there's been incremental benefit really across the board if you use that agent in the first line setting. We also talked about some of the angiogenesis inhibitors in the second line setting. So in addition to bevacizumab, you could also look at zivaflibercept and ramucirumab. And then we talked about the use of EGFR inhibitors in the first line setting. I kind of highlighted the CRYSTAL trial, but there's a whole bunch of different studies that can be discussed, including the PRIME trial of panitumumab. But basically using an EGFR targeting monoclonal antibody in the first line setting and in combination. And then we talked about where you would pick maybe one versus the other, and what's the information we need to make treatment decisions in the first line settings. Yeah, there's a whole host of molecular markers we need to test for in colorectal cancer. One of the first ones is microsatellite stability or mismatch repair proficiency or deficiency. So there we're looking for basically the editing function in DNA and making sure that patients don't have an inherited defect in that editing, so-called Lynch syndrome, where patients are at risk of multiple tumor types. And we suggest that this should be tested reflexively, i.e. every patient with colorectal cancer should have this tested. Because if you pick up a case, you can actually treat an entire family. And you're looking at siblings, children, parents, cousins, second cousins, et cetera. So you can really help an entire family by putting people who are at high risk of these cancers into a screening program. So microsatellite stability, where you're doing a PCR-based test, or mismatch repair, where you're doing immunohistochemistry. Now, both of those are kind of two sides of the same coin, in a way, trying to pick up either inherited or acquired mismatch repair. And if patients have that, whether it's inherited or acquired, you're going to be thinking about immunotherapy. The thinking is that those patients, because they have over 1,500 or 1,700 mutations, there's a lot of abnormal proteins, and the immune system can recognize and work effectively against those tumor types. Unfortunately, it's only about, you know, depending on the stage, sort of 3 to 15% or so of tumor types. 3 to 15% of colorectal cancer patients, depending on stage. The second thing we talked about was RAS status. So if patients have a KRAS or an NRAS mutation, they tend not to respond to the epidermal growth factor receptor inhibitors, such as panitumumab or cetuximab. So that's very important, because the last thing you want to do is give an ineffective drug and possibly a harmful drug to patients that aren't going to benefit. Unfortunately, we don't have drugs that target RAS, but we know what not to do if someone has a RAS mutation, especially in the first line setting. We discussed BRAF, which is a mutation, again, roughly 18 to 15% of colorectal cancer patients, the most common one being at the 600 position, V600E. And those patients tend to have a worse prognosis overall, but we increasingly have BRAF-directed combination therapies that are now in the NCCN guidelines and other guidelines. So that's sort of a special set of patients that you want to pick up. And then there's some overlap between BRAF and microsatellite high patients, because many BRAF patients have a hypermethylation of MLH1 and therefore will have resultant microsatellite instability, even though it's not inherited. HER2 is coming. There's not as much data as we'd like to have, but it would be good to know if you have a HER2 patient that's HER2 amplified or HER2 overexpressing, because there are some interesting therapeutic strategies that can be used in that case. Larotrectinib was recently approved for NTRK fusion patients. So they're very rare, but you can pick those up. So increasingly, really, it's a really whole battery of tests that need to be done in colorectal cancer to figure out how to treat patients, especially as you get into the second and third line setting.
Next, Christopher Liu, MD, Director of the GI Medical Oncology Program, Deputy Associate Director for Clinical Research, and Associate Professor at the University of Colorado Cancer Center, sat down with us to expand on the exciting research with biomarker-directed therapy and immunotherapy in relapsed refractory metastatic colorectal cancer. He told us that although these advances have been made in only a small percentage of the overall CRC population, these personalized approaches have led to significant improvements in survival.
So there are two biomarkers that are really becoming of significant interest. So BRAF, patients with BRAF V600E mutations, this is a subgroup that's about 5 to 10% of our patient population with metastatic colorectal cancer. We know that this particular mutation confers really poor prognosis, that sometimes patients that have this mutation literally have an overall survival that's about a third of what we would normally expect. And a lot of this is simply due to it's an aggressive cancer and our standard therapies do not work for it. It's important that providers test for this mutation, and they also know that not only is it prognostic, but it could be predictive of benefit from this treatment. We also talked about HER2 therapy and HER2 amplified colorectal cancer. So HER2 is a gene that's very famous in breast cancer. We also know that there's data in gastric cancer, but we now are starting to have data in colorectal cancer. And so we know that patients that have HER2 amplified colorectal cancer may not receive any benefit from anti-EGFR therapy. We also know that there are anti-HER2 therapies available for other tumor types, and there are ongoing studies looking at the addition of anti-HER2 therapy in patients with refractory metastatic colorectal cancer. So there's an ongoing trial across the country called SWOG-1613, looking at the combination of trastuzumab and pertuzumab in patients that have previously received treatment for HER2 amplified metastatic colorectal cancer. So this is a trial that's ongoing, and we just want we want providers to be aware of this, because number one, there may be evidence to suggest that our anti-EGFR therapy isn't going to work in these patients that have HER2 amplification. The second reason why we want providers to know about this is because there's a clinical trial available, and because that clinical trial has crossover allowed in it, those patients are going to have an option, a clinical option, that they wouldn't otherwise have. So it's very important for providers to know about the data and to know what clinical trial options there are available. For, you know, patients with metastatic refractory metastatic colorectal cancer, you know, we've seen incredible improvements in median overall survival for this patient population, but our patients desperately need better treatment options. You know, one of the big areas in oncology right now is immunotherapy. Immunotherapy thus far has not worked for 95% of our patients with metastatic colorectal cancer, those patients that are called microsatellite stable or proficient mismatch repair. So you're going to see more and more immunotherapies being tested in clinical trials for this group of patients. But really, where I see a lot of the results that are truly positive is in these kind of small biomarker-directed subgroups.
Next, Sujatha Nalapal Reddy, MD, a gastrointestinal medical oncologist at Rocky Mountain Cancer Centers, stopped by to share how a better understanding of CRC biology has provided more opportunities for personalized treatment approaches in patients. In our interview, Nalapal Reddy explained how studies like the CALGB SWOG 80405 trial offered a clearer picture of the differences between right and left-sided tumors, and how that information can be used to better tailor therapies based on tumor location. Beyond this, Nalapal Reddy provided insight into the work being done with immunotherapy in patients with microsatellite instability high tumors and the challenges still faced with that approach.
Until recently, we were not very clear about how to decide treatment options between right-sided and left-sided tumors. But with the CALGB 8045 trial, we got the data showing that right-sided tumors do behave differently from the left-sided tumors. And so with the data available now, we know that left-sided tumors have better overall survival compared to the right-sided tumors, is one thing which we have learned. And we don't know, is it mainly because of the microbiome, or is it because of the alterations like KRAS mutations and BRAF mutations are more common in right-sided versus left-sided tumors? We don't know. But one thing is the prognosis, and the second thing is the treatment options. For left-sided tumors, we did realize from the study that EGFR antibodies work better for left-sided tumors, and VEGF antibodies work better in right-sided tumors. And I think in my practice, like if I see a patient with metastatic right-sided colon cancer, I would prefer to use FOLFOX with bevacizumab instead of FOLFOX with cetuximab, even in KRAS wild-type patient, while I would do the opposite in left-sided tumors, where I would use FOLFOX and cetuximab to get robust response for those patients. So the main therapies which we have seen lately in the colorectal cancer arena is the use of immunotherapy, especially in patients with MSI unstable tumors is one thing. And then how we are trying to personalize therapies and use of targeted therapies, especially like cetuximab and bevacizumab treatment, where we are seeing right-sided versus left-sided therapy, where it's more personalized. And the new therapies with targeted agents like regorafenib and lonsurf, and the REDOS trial, where how we are trying to introduce regorafenib, where we are dose escalating so that patients can tolerate the treatments better and get the benefit of the drugs. The challenges with immunotherapy is how do we incorporate this immunotherapy in MSS stable patient, and if there is any role for immunotherapy or combination of immunotherapy with chemotherapy in colorectal cancer patients with who are MSI stable. And I know there are a lot of trials going on to see if these MSS stable tumors, which are cold, if they can induce immune response by using of immunotherapy along with the chemotherapy. And it's exciting to see all these trials going on, and I think we'll be waiting for the results of these trials.
Meanwhile, in pancreatic cancer, several novel treatment approaches have emerged, such as neoadjuvant therapy, said Alan L. Cohn, MD, a medical oncologist at Rocky Mountain Cancer Centers. When Cohn sat down with us at the meeting, he painted a picture of the neoadjuvant and adjuvant settings, shed light on the PRODIGE 24 CCTG PA6 trial, and discussed some emerging agents and approaches that are generating excitement in the field.
My presentation really just highlights the sort of last few years in pancreatic cancer in terms of metastatic or advanced disease, looking at first-line therapies and second-line therapies, and then looking a little bit about recent adjuvant chemotherapy trials that were reported last year. You know, for years we had gemcitabine as a standard of care drug, and after that came FOLFIRINOX. a combination with great response rates, a lot of toxicity, and then that was followed by combining gemcitabine with nab-paclitaxel with some good response rates, not quite as good as FOLFIRINOX, but pretty good in general, a little bit less toxicities. And in terms of adjuvant chemotherapies, you know, we used to use gemcitabine for years, and now there's good data that FOLFIRINOX is much better than gemcitabine in terms of overall survival and progression-free survival. I think in neoadjuvant, it's sort of becoming not quite the mainstay of treatment, but certainly for borderline resectable patients, trying to shrink tumors down and make them resectable, so hopefully we can get more R0 resections and better survivals with patients with either locally advanced, you know, that are borderline resectable, of giving chemotherapy and radiation and then surgery followed by adjuvant chemotherapy. And not a lot of studies are looking at it. The Mayo Clinic recently reported some data that if patients receive neoadjuvant therapy, their CA19-9 levels normalize, they received full courses of therapy and they showed some major shrinkages, we are seeing survivals of, you know, close to 50 to 60 months.
Immunotherapy is an exciting area of ongoing research in gastric and GEJ cancer, but investigators still need to determine which setting and for which patient subsets this strategy will provide the most benefit, said S. Lindsay Davis, MD, an assistant professor of medicine and gastrointestinal medical oncologist at the University of Colorado Cancer Center. In our interview, Davis discussed the Phase 3 KEYNOTE-062 trial, which evaluated the combination of pembrolizumab with or without chemotherapy as frontline treatment for patients with advanced disease, as well as the latest immunotherapy developments across settings.
Immunotherapy has been a really exciting area in gastric and GE junction cancer, currently approved in the third line setting for people who have PD-L1 positive disease. There are many ongoing clinical trials in this area. The large clinical trial that we talked about specifically to the KEYNOTE trial in gastric and GE junction cancer was actually negative with no significant benefit in overall survival, progression-free survival, or response. So that study was negative in terms of a treatment compared to paclitaxel. However, there are multiple ongoing studies in different lines of therapy, definitely looking in multiple different spaces. And I think of note in that trial, they specifically enrolled patients or found that there was some benefit in the population who had a CPS score, so that's the PD-L positivity of the tumor. So the CPS of 1 or greater, they found in during the clinical trial that there was a better response in that group of patients. However, when they did the analysis after the study was completed, when they looked at even higher scores, so a CPS of 10, they found that that population seemed to have an even better outcome with that type of therapy. So it may be that we need to select the patients even more narrowly for that higher score and higher degree of PD-L1 positivity in the tumor, if we use that as a biomarker. And there are multiple other settings ongoing in which we're looking at immunotherapy, including the curative setting. We have an adjuvant study ongoing evaluating nivolumab following chemo radiation in the curative intent setting for esophageal and GE junction cancer. So still a lot of opportunities and new combinations. Another ongoing trial that we talked about, or early phase trial that we talked about, was a phase 2 study actually in the HER2 positive setting, where they evaluated combining immunotherapy with the standard chemotherapy and trastuzumab in that disease, and the benefit in terms of response was actually extremely high. So partial responses in 87% of patients and disease control rate of 100% in a small population of patients. So a phase 2 trial, but something that is exciting and we'll find out more from in terms of a phase 3 study down the road. So I think ongoing issues, really the key is where is immunotherapy best served and in what subset of those patients according to the PD-L1 status, et cetera. I think also in the patients with esophageal cancer, squamous cell is an area that we haven't had a lot of specific trials to evaluate. So those patients, we always have a difficult time figuring out what to do for them. So I think that's another area of interest. And then I think just understanding better the molecular subtypes of the cancer so we can tailor our treatments better and identify those options. And then better kind of navigating first, second, third, fourth line setting treatments and figuring out where immunotherapy fits in.
We closed out the night with Anthony B. El-Khoueiry, MD, an associate professor of clinical medicine at the University of Southern California's Keck School of Medicine, who told us how the armamentarium for advanced hepatocellular carcinoma has expanded in recent years, going from just one drug, sorafenib, to a plethora of options. Beyond TKIs, PD-1 inhibitors such as nivolumab and pembrolizumab, and VEGFR2 inhibitors such as ramucirumab have all entered the treatment paradigm. In our interview, El-Khoueiry walked us through the rapidly evolving treatment options in HCC.
So the treatment of advanced HCC has changed quite a bit in the past few years. And let me define advanced HCC for a minute. The classic definition of advanced HCC is what we call Barcelona Clinic Liver Cancer Stage C, which is by definition patients with portal vein invasion or extrahepatic metastases. The other group that's included in advanced HCC and systemic therapy trials are the patients with multifocal disease limited to the liver, who have progressed on locoregional therapy, or are not candidate for locoregional therapy. Here I'll take a moment to emphasize the fact that there is a subgroup of patients with BCLC-B disease, meaning liver-limited disease, but have large lesions and diffusely throughout the liver. And these patients may not be best served with locoregional therapy and may go directly to systemic treatment. So this is the population that's classically included in systemic therapy trials. The treatment has evolved quite a bit because we've gone from having just one drug, which is sorafenib, for about 10 years, to having a multitude of options at the moment. So I'll quickly run through these options by line of therapy. So starting in first line, we now have a non-inferiority study that compared lenvatinib to sorafenib and was positive. So it showed us that lenvatinib was non-inferior to sorafenib as far as overall survival. So that adds a new first line option. Then we go to second line. The first study that was positive in second line is the RESOURCE trial that compared regorafenib to placebo. This was a 2-to-1 randomization, and it was a positive study with superior overall survival compared to placebo. The median overall survival actually was about 10 to 11 months, kind of quite similar to what we saw in the SHARP trial in first line. It also was positive as far as PFS and response rate. Both of these secondary endpoints were superior to placebo. That patient population was quite unique. There were patients who tolerated sorafenib. That was a definition that they must have tolerated 400 milligrams daily or higher for the last 20 of 28 days, and they were all Child-Pugh-A. So it is a select population. Nonetheless, this was a positive study. Regorafenib is now an FDA-approved option post-sorafenib. Another agent that has been evaluated in second and third line is cabozantinib, which is another multi-targeted tyrosine kinase inhibitor. The targets of cabozantinib include VEGF receptor 2, AXL, and MET, among others. this was a study that didn't select patient by MET expression, unlike a previous negative study done with tivatinib. And again, to emphasize what was unique about this trial is about a third of the patients were third-line patients. This study again met its primary endpoint of superior overall survival with cabozantinib compared to placebo. Again, in the similar range with a median overall survival of 10 months or so. Another agent that's been evaluated in this space, the post-sorafenib space, is ramucirumab, which is an antibody against VEGF receptor 2. There's a bit of a story behind this. Ramucirumab was first evaluated in what's called the REACH trial, and that was a negative study. However, in a subgroup analysis, it appeared that the patients with AFP above 400 had a benefit with ramucirumab. So the sponsor went ahead and repeated a study called REACH 2, in which there was a selection or an eligibility criterion for AFP being at 400 or above. Child-Pugh-A, and all patients must have been exposed to sorafenib. This was again a positive study with ramucirumab showing superior overall survival compared to placebo. The overall survival was in the 8 month range, and the absolute benefit was around 1 point some month. So it was a bit smaller than what we're used to seeing, is around 3 months with the other agents. However, there may be, you know, trial to trial comparisons are unfair, and there may be some selection criteria that affected this. There was a joint analysis or combined analysis of REACH 2 and the original REACH trial for all patients with AFP above 400. And when these two trials are put together, we see again an improvement of about 3 months in overall survival with ramucirumab. Now, what I didn't cover yet are the immune agents. So the anti-PD-1 antibodies, both nivolumab and pembrolizumab, have accelerated approval post-sorafenib. Nivolumab has accelerated approval based on the CheckMate 040 trial. This was a phase 1-2 study, quite large, over 250 patients in total. The overall response rate with nivolumab was 20%, putting all the cohorts together. When focusing on the post-sorafenib cohort, which got the accelerated approval, the response rate was close to 15%. What's important about these responses is that they were quite durable, with a median duration, depending on which cohort was looked at, reaching as long as 18 months per cohort. When looking at just the patients who were post-sorafenib, the median duration of response was 10 months or longer. Pembrolizumab was evaluated in a phase 2 study as well, slightly over 100 patients, a similar response rate of around 17% as well. Again, durability was comparable, side effect was comparable. So both of these agents have similar activity in this space.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to OncLive on Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have several upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you would like to learn more about the treatment advances made in lung cancer, consider registering for the October 3rd State of the Science Summit in Cleveland, Ohio. We will also be hosting a State of the Science Summit on October 16th in Austin, Texas, which will focus on progress made with precision medicine and oncology. To check out the list of upcoming meetings or to register, go to onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit. And don't forget to follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive on Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive on Air.